Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, the 6th of October 2018, page 10. Sorry about this, says I was interrupted by rain last time and I don't know how long I'll be able to go on here. It's just before dinner, so I'll see how it goes. But it is important that I keep on working on this. It's like any rehab, you have to really push yourself. So, AI eavesdrops on Borneo's rainforest. So you've got a few ticks here. Artificial intelligence, which is sort of machine learning or presenting it and actually letting it randomly pick its own, write its own program. And Borneo's rainforest, again, you'd be very interested in that because there's orangutans, it's something under threat. So it's Richard Kamey. Solar-powered recording devices are eavesdroppings on rainforests in Borneo to monitor biodiversity. The plan is to use artificial intelligence. They're not going to use it, they're planning to use it, guys, to identify the sounds of different animals and track changes in their numbers over time. So the plan is to do it. So they've just said, oh, I'm planning to do it in artificial intelligence. Many current methods for checking biodiversity are impractical, relying on people to regularly change batteries in recorders, for example. Or they are expensive, requiring huge reams of data to be sent via satellites. So Sahab Sarathy of Imperial College London and his team developed a pared-down device built around a Raspberry Pi, a mass-produced, low-cost mini computer. I really want to get that up. Solar panels peeking out above the forest canopy can provide power, while local mobile networks send data almost immediately to remote servers accessed online. The devices can carry various sensors to capture audio, images, and atmospheric information. So far, 12 monitors. So these monitors, I think, cost $10 each, these Raspberry Pis. 12 monitors nestled in the canopy have recorded over 10,000 hours of audio. So each one has been for 8 hours. So perhaps 8 hours is a couple of weeks. Okay. One will work like a Shazam for species. Shazam is an app that allows people to identify a song from the artist from a sound recording. In a similar way, AI algorithms will recognize different animals from their calls and call and use this to gauge how their populations change. Well, this is a bit speculative, mate. The other method takes a more holistic approach, creating an overall audio fingerprint of the forest. By analysing how this alters over time, or in different areas of the forest, researchers can gauge the wider health of the section of the forest. Very dubious, mate. The work is part of a broader project documenting the effect of palm oil plantations on the forest in Borneo. Since trees will continue to be cleared, we want to find out which forest fragments will preserve the maximum amount of biodiversity, says Sith. Yep, it seems that you can almost say anything you want. Okay, this looks a bit gruesome. Spain lost its men to ancient invasion, sounds like one of those thousands of years ago conquests. This is page 12, October the 6th, 2018. So there's a picture here of a skull picturing up. And so the bones, they're saying the Yamaya left their bones in Europe and their genes all over Europe. A genetic analysis has revealed that about 4,500 years ago, part of southern Europe was conquered from the east in what is now Spain and Portugal, with the local male line vanished almost overnight. The males from outside became the only ones to leave descendants. David Reich of the Harvard Medical School presented the results recently at the New Scientist Live in London. Oh, well, there you go. That's how you get it on. There were several waves of human migration into across Europe far back into prehistoric times. That doesn't say very much. One of the most significant began around 5,000 years ago, when a population that rose from far eastern Europe on the steep of the Black and Caspian Seas steppes swept westward. And that's what always seems to happen. They sweep across, don't they? Archaeologists call them the Yamaya. Yamnaya. They were pastoralists who relied on grazing animals rather than growing crops. So it's a bit of a throwback idea, isn't it? Quote, "The wheel had shortly before been invented and the horse domesticated," said Reich. The Yamaya hitched horses to wagons and used them to carry supplies out of the open steppe, allowing them to tend large grazing herds and exploit the steppe better than any other group done before. It's really interesting that they can it's pottery. Often the pottery has pictures with wheels on it. So, oh, that's how it is. And, of course, obviously the potter's wheel. The potter's wheel. You know. So often the wheel is done by pottery. See how this goes here. Before Yama arose, a host of different cultures existed on the steppe. Each left behind a distinctive artifacts. Most of these groups then disappeared and were replaced by homogeneous Yamaya culture. So this is saying a more complex thing, that there's a steep, is undergoing rapid cultural evolution in itself. And then this one peaks out of the steep. These people spread over a vast territory from Mongolia to Hungary and then to Europe. Well, that's the Mongolian Empire again. Isn't it? Mongolia and Hungary, isn't that the Mongolian Empire? And the single primary most important contributors to Europeans today, says Reich. He had previously speculated that the Indo-European languages, a vast group including most modern European tongues, were first brought to Europe by the Yamana around the same time that they arrived in Europe. So you can actually do genetic testing of mutations. You can see how these bloody noisy birds here of languages and see how ancient they are. Around the same time Yamana arrived in Europe, people in the vicinity of Spain began making distinctive beakers. There's the beaker culture. I can remember this beaker. It seems to be associated with a set of religious belief known as the beaker culture. Hello, bird. You going to leave me alone? That is a big red parrot there. Thanks a lot, you overseas listeners are listening to you, mate. Okay, right, that's enough. You know, let me read this. Okay, it first spread by word of mouth until the incoming Yamada adopted it. Oh, the culture spread by word of mouth, and then the culture adopted it. At which point it became the marker of expansion. From my reading, I think it was Lithuania was when I remembered that being done. To get more complete picture of this expansion in the Spanish region, Reich and his colleagues have extracted a sequence of DNA bones from people living at the area in the time. I'm pretty sure the beaker culture was, if I remember, it was from Lithuania that way. The DNA suggests that Yamanda's descendants began mixing with the locals around 4,500 years ago. Okay, well, we'll be following the mitochondria and Y chromosome. The resulting population had 40% of Yamada ancestry and 60% of local ancestry. But that's not the complete story. The team found a dramatic shift in the Y chromosome, which there are only carried by males. There's a complete Y chromosome replacement. The original male's DNA vanished from the gene pool. That means the male coming in had preferential access to the females and again, oh my god, said Reich. This is suggestive of a violent conquest in which an invading army killed the enslaved local males, or the males looked much better, I suppose, and took the local females for their own. The collision of these two populations was not a friendly one. They might have been much better gentlemen, The collision of these two populations was not a friendly one, not an equal one, but there were males from the outside were displacing local males and did so almost completely, said Reich. Well, they just could have been just more debonair, better dancers, better at their dancing. This could have happened if the society had come firmly under control of the invading males and the females would have been treated as second-class citizens or even property. Well, I think that's mostly likely, but there are other alternatives. The new finding in the line with the result was reported in July 2017 by Rue Martinier, now at the University of Cambridge, and his colleagues based on the genomes of 14 ancient people. Just 14. Well, let's see. Out of 14, half of those are female, if you're lucky. So you've got 7 genomes. You've got 7 Y chromosomes. Now, what's more is that you've got to be before and after 500 years. God, that's a bit crap. They also found that the local Y chromosomes were rapidly replaced in Iberia, suggesting a male-dominated incursion. Let me read that one again. Oh, 14... No? People. 14 ancient peoples? Oh, no, people. Persons. Oh, I don't know. That'd be really bad if it was the actual just people. Violent conquests might have been a common occurrence as the Yamandas' descendants swept across Europe. In February, Reich's team published a similar study that investigated the ancient DNA reveals about the arrival of Yamandas' descendants on the British shores 4,500 years ago. The ancient genetic signatures suggested within a few hundred years about 90% of the local gene pool was replaced. The people who made Stonehenge were seemingly wiped out. Stonehenge, and a few of their genes have survived to the present day. The previous style of artifacts was replaced by the Bell Beaker culture. Oh, far out. I hate those Bell Beaker people. Oh, crap. It's not clear what happened, but the newcomers may have carried unfamiliar diseases that wiped out the locals. The climate was shifting at the time, which might have added to the problems the locals experienced. Well, that's pretty much... I don't... It's just... They would... Oh, it could... I was trying to think it could have been a venereal disease, but that's interesting. The that's poorly expressed articles. I'm sure it's more stress there that the must be general knowledge that the Stone Age people have been wiped... Stonehenge people have been wiped out. Okay, a hunt for alien life is far from over. So remember, this is the city they're looking out for radio signals, which are non-natural cause. And you've got Fermi's paradox saying, if the universe is full of intelligent life, why haven't we they called? I wonder if they've got the Fermi's paradox in here. I said the word paradox somewhere. Oh yeah, Fermi, that's the second paragraph. With billions of stars in our galaxy, many orbited by habitable planets, the chances that... Oh, so this is by Douglas Heaven. It's interesting that Douglas Heaven will write this one. With billions of stars in our galaxy, many orbited by habitable planets, many orbited by... Or they think so. The chances there should be advanced life capable of reaching out across the void. Yet after decades of looking and listening, we found nothing. This apparent contradiction is known as Fermi's paradox. Some have used it to argue that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is doomed. Okay, so Fermi's paradox is that if there are so many people out there, how come we haven't seen it? I don't know what the argument would be based on that. But a mathematical analysis of the SETI search has done so far claims that the usual explanation of the paradox, that there's nobody out there, is false. Now, that's a bit of a heavy statement. Instead, it suggests the best explanation is simply that we have scratched the surface in our hunt for aliens. Now that makes me a bit concerned reading that one. Jason Wright at Pennsylvania State University and his colleagues analysed that many variables involved in SETI, which involve searching for radio signals from other civilizations. These include what to look for, where to look for, how often, for how long. They then devised an equation that computes the fraction of the galaxies checked so far. Quote, it lets you build the haystack and then calculate how much of it you looked. This is right. The team says the volume of the galaxy that has been checked by certified is roughly equivalent to just one single bathtub of water in the world's oceans. Quote, you don't have to do a calculation to say we've only just started. But they have. Let me work this one out. They've devised an equation. Okay, what? This one's someone else. This is Duncan Fogan at the University of St Andrews, UK. He's a member of the UK SETI research, but they've done a nice job of showing the huge scale of the problem mathematically. There you go, mate. Okay, this bird's giving me the craps. As well as putting SETI into context of the equation, researchers can see that search techniques have been used less than others. For example, we only developed the technology to listen for higher radio frequencies quite recently, but we're getting better at doing that, so variable will now shrink. However, advances in technology will only take us so far. Certain variables, such as how often aliens' messages might be repeated, cannot be changed. A signal sent out once a year can only be listened out for once a year. Okay, thank you for telling me that one. I'd like to... Well, it can be listened out to many more times, so you're only going to hear it for... Let me read that sentence again. A signal sent out once a year can only be listened out for once a year. Oh dear. There are things we can do better and things we can't, said Swagan. We have just to sit back and wait for the universe to do its thing. Or the galaxy, I mean the universe. Fergan has a book coming out, oh well of course he does, that discusses 66 potential explanations of Fermi's paradox. This includes the possibility that Earth is somehow unusual in its ability to harbor intelligent life, that our technological civilizations are rare, or perhaps their common but short-lived genetic and nuclear disasters might wipe them out. Other explanations suggest aliens may be hiding from us, or perhaps live in parts of the galaxy it's hard to see with telescopes, such as the galactic center with its supermassive black hole. Yes, our civilization, I'm going to live right in front of a black hole and have radiation absolutely spewing through the place. Cats are actually surprisingly bad at catching rats, says Michael Lepage. If you are plagued by rats, think twice about getting a cat. A prowling feline might lead to the appearance of a cat-free home, but it turns out rats are still there. They're just keeping a low profile. Quote, cats are not the natural enemy of rats, says Michael Parsons of Fordham University in New York. Quote, they prefer smaller prey. His team has been studying a rat colony in the recycling plant in New York. When feral cats moved into the plants last year, the researchers were dismayed. Oh no, not the feral cats, oh bloody hell. But decided to set up infrared cameras to monitor the area. Oh, bloody hell. Over 5 months, they saw just 3 attempts by cats to catch rats. The little camera shy out there. Only 2 of which succeeded. The rat population is still thriving, says Parsons. In the frontiers of ecology and evolution. Cats have good reason to be cautious. The common rat, Rattus norvegicus, the Norwegian rat, has a large incisors and can inflict a painful bite and carry lots of diseases, not like you beautiful cats. They also weigh 430 grams on average compared with 25 grams for a mouse. I'd like to know how you know that one, mate. Parson thinks that only starving cats will attempt to tackle rats unless the rats are sick or injured. The 2 rats killed during the team study may have been weakened by eating poisoned baits. Or have they? Oh, surely you'd be able to tell. However, cats do have a big... Okay, there's 3 attempts and only 2 cats, the 2 rats killed. However, cats do have a big influence over rat behaviour. Rats overestimate the risk of posed by cats. Sparson. His team found out, well maybe they're just by keeping out of the place they don't get caught. No, I think this is really confused. I think they keep away because the cats can actually kill them. Okay, the team found that the cats own the area. Rats spend more time in hiding and creeping around cautiously. That means they're much less likely to be seen by people, which could explain why most people wrongly think cats are good at killing rats. Okay, well that's right. You bring a cat and you don't see your rats around the place, so that's a good point. Some cat owners may be convinced that their pets are excellent ratters, but Parson found that many people mistake mice for rats. Well, that's a survey thing. I don't know if he's qualified at identifying what the scientific thing of that one is. That said, it's possible there are a few exceptional moggies that do take on healthy adult rats, he says. Well, I don't know how he's found it. If it's his own personal opinion, or it should be in a science magazine. Spot cybercrime before it happens. Okay. Douglas Heaven again. The internet can seem lawless, but a new technique for identifying potential cybercriminals may help police intervene before people do something illegal. Oh, don't let them do something illegal. Big cyber attacks like NotPetya ransomware hit many countries in 2017, grabbed the headlines. But cybercrime is a constant problem, with many smaller attacks carried out by people with little technical know-how using malware traded online. Alice Hutchings, Sergey Pranster, and colleagues at the University of Cambridge want to identify those who may be thinking of buying such malware and intervene. Okay, they're probably illegal downloadings as well. The team used natural language processing software to analyze conversations on hack forums, a site with around 3 million users. Their system scanned 10 years of data from 250,000 users and spotted 80 individuals who later became involved in cybercrime. Given the widespread use of hacking tools amongst the young people, these are people who are caught in cybercrime. The Home Office said it would rather intervene than prosecute where possible. I'm just trying to work this out. To this end, Hutchings is helping to shape the UK National Crime Agency's response to cybercrime. I just can't help but help him shape it. Okay, I don't understand. That's the response. But when the NCA started to tackle cybercrime, it was surprised at how young many perpetrators were. A disproportionate amount of them were not just young, but ridiculously young. A lot of them under 20. I like that. If you're under 20, you're ridiculously young, says Greg Francis from the Prevent team at the NCA's National Cybercrime Unit. When the individuals are identified as being likely to get involved in cybercrime, they might receive a written warning or a visit from a police officer. Some people don't realise the implication of what they're doing, or that it's illegal. Of course, snooping online activity is sometimes with ethical baggage, and there is only so much you can learn by tracking public conversations. Quote, I'd be very interested in what happens privately, but that creates additional ethical issues, says Hutchings. The team presented the work at the International Symposium on Research in Attacks, Intrusions, Defences in Greece early this month, but they wanted to go to Greece anyway. But the entire thing is that 10 years of data, and you know who you're going to track. I don't know, I think it's very dodgy. Second World War bombs affect the edge of space by Andy Coughlin. Shockwaves from Allied bombing raids between 43 and 65 killed millions in Germany. They were so powerful enough to disrupt the outermost layer of the atmosphere. I would be interested to know if they killed millions, because I think they lost 2 million on the Eastern Front and 2 to 4 million on the Eastern Front, 6 million Jews, and it'd be interesting if they did. Germany did lose millions. This layer, the ionosphere, consists mainly of molecular nitrogen and molecular oxygen and individual oxygen atoms, which electrons get detached by solar X-rays and ultraviolet sunlight. I just have to say the major thing is there's no water there. It's very dry, and so we've got mostly molecular oxygen and oxygen here. And I think most of the you've got the Schumann-Runge dissociation and stuff like that. But you can actually ionize an oxygen molecule with something. It's actually got lower ionization energy. Okay, electrons typically rejoin hydrogen ions within minutes, so the layer reaches a stable ratio between atomic oxygen, ionic oxygen, and free electrons. The impact of the sun's radiation on the ionosphere is now well established, but the impact on the terrestrial activity from below is less well understood. Okay. To provide new insights, researchers turned to the dark days of the Second World War. This was an attempt to find quantifiable explosive phenomena that might have impact on the ionosphere. This is Christoph, University of Reading, says, who co-authored the study with his colleague, Patrick Major. Well, I'm just really struck to see how a bomb can change the ionization. Like a bomb, you don't feel a crackle. What's the process which an explosion would go up? I don't know. But look, UK historical records was logged the density of the ionosphere between 1933 and 96. For data, the pair could estimate the electron density in the ionosphere during the war. Like among the results, the records describe the number and size of bombs dropped in the major air raids on Germany and occupied France between 43 and 45, which is going to estimate the degree of the bombing altering the electron density. During the height of the bombing campaign, the shockwaves were temporarily lowering the electron concentration as much as 3%. The effects were seen 1,000 kilometres away from the bombing and 300 kilometres up. Why not just aerosols chucked up? He says shockwaves deplete electron concentration by dumping energy into the atmosphere, which causes the oxygen ions and electrons to react with nitrogen and oxygen molecules. Oh, look, I must admit. Yeah, if a bomb drops Germany and you're... look, I find that very hard to believe. It's interesting that human activity can have such an impact on the upper research atmosphere, says Stephen Cummer of the Duke University in North Carolina. I'm interested. It's sort of unusual. Sorry, being a bit of a skeptic here. Let's see what we're doing for time. I'll have to go in. Filter feeding rays really made for fine dining. There's a really interesting picture of filter feeding rays. The puzzle of how mantle rays manage to gorge a minute plankton has been solved. They have a special food filtration system that makes solid ricochet back into their mouths when they drain seawater. Now, that's interesting. If they've got a special mechanism, we could possibly use that to filter our water. Imagine that. Filter feeders use different techniques to trap food. In fish, it usually involves gills that work as a sieve, letting water through while retaining food particles larger than the sieve pores. And it has been thought that mantle rays use this method, but then gut analysis found large amounts of plankton smaller than the pores and their gills. To investigate this, Misty Peg Trang of the California State University and her colleagues, Misty, MISTYPAIG-TRAN, Tran, I think, is a Vietnamese name, and her colleagues 3D printed a model of a segment of mantle ray gill and let water carrying solid particles flow through it. Although the model had a pore size of 340 micrometers, so 1,000 micrometers is a millimeter. Yeah, so that's like a third of a millimetre, why don't you just say that? It managed to capture particles right down to 150 micrometres. Using a simulation, the researchers worked out how this is possible. The mantle rays filter looks like a row of slanted domino tiles, and it alters the trajectories of solids and liquids differently. When water hits the filter, it turns sharply and passes through the gaps between the tiles. But the solid particles are unable to take such a sharp turn. Instead, they ricochet off the filter into the fish's mouth. The team calls filtration system ricochet separation. So really what you'd want to do is to produce many, many models and vary it and see what was going on before you made this conclusion. Boost to brain, a boost for deep brain simulation. A fluke experiment has hinted that depression really can be treated by deep brain simulation. DBS, a therapy that uses implanted electrodes to simulate part of the brain for people in Germany whose depression had kept at bay for 4 years by DBS, had sudden relapses. They recovered in around 12 hours when they found the implant batteries had gone flat. Oh, and they were replaced. Oh. Immediately replaced, I suppose. Another person relapsed after he decided he didn't need his DBS anymore and switched the system off. Dog off. He also recovered after reactivating him. In these cases, deliver a very strong message against it being a placebo effect. Oh my God, Father, says Thomas Schleifer, who treated all fives at the University of Freiburg Medical Center in Germany. His team now plans a follow-up trial of 60 people. Perhaps they've got deep brain simulators for something else besides the depression. RoboLeech calls on you to check your health. Oh God. Robots are great exploring hard-to-reach places up your butt, so soon they may crawl over people's bodies and conduct medical examinations when doctors aren't available, for example, in the battlefield or in collapsed buildings. And here's this little mechanical thing going across him. Artem Dmitriev at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and his colleagues want to create a small helper robots that will live on our skin. They want to do it. It's like this planning to use AI. Their latest Skinbot is a palm-sized bipedal robot with suction-cut feet inspired by the cephalopods and leeches. The cups help it walk over skin. It can scale your back and pick its way through the hair on the head and groin. Thank you. Well, that would be excruciating. The camera and microscope and sensors detecting electrical signals from the skin. It lets to see wounds and lesions and check the heart's electrical activity. The team thinks such robots will eventually give injections, carry out minor surgery, and work together on a range of and arrange themselves around the heart to perform multiple electrocardiograms. Well, that would be actually quite interesting. The next version of Skinbot will maybe be made from soft materials like silicone. I imagine tiny robot looks and moves like an inchworm, says Dimitri. So his own imagination gets up here. Okay, giraffe spot sizes influence survival. Mm-hmm. Giraffes may look identical to us, but we now know that we lose our ability to distinguish things as we grow old. I can't remember where I read that. But none of us has exactly the same markings and certain patterns, especially large. I think it was in the final word. Okay. Yes, son? Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.